Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 23rd, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Last Tuesday, Lyndon LaRouche presented a compelling argument in his webcast for the immediate restoration of Glass-Steagall as the law regulating the U.S. banking industry. He said that if Glass-Steagall is not passed, you can forget about the United States. It is gone. With the chain reaction collapse in Europe entering a new phase with an immediate prospect of a default by Greece, the whole transatlantic system is headed toward an imminent blowout. The situation in Europe is immediate. The Portuguese bailout may not come through because of the vote in Finland last weekend. The Irish government is hanging on by its fingernails. The Greek government had to offer 22% interest rates to be able to sell two-year bonds on Thursday and Friday. And that is, of course, unsustainable. So Europe is on a fast track toward complete disintegration. As for the United States, the dollar hit a three-year low on Friday. Gold prices soared above $1,500 an ounce this week. And the hyperinflationary increase in the price of gasoline, raw materials, and food continues. It's so bad that even World Bank President Robert Zoellick warned that, quote, we are one shock away from a full-blown crisis, unquote. So I can repeat what Lyndon LaRouche said at his webcast, that without Glass-Steagall, our nation will not survive. Well, the good news is there is a bill now in the Congress to reinstate Glass-Steagall. It's House Resolution 1489, and it means very simply that we can save the nation by making sure this bill is passed. It was introduced by Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat from Ohio. The other co-sponsors, the initial co-sponsors, include Jim Moran, a Democrat from Virginia, and Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina. So for those of you who are worried about bipartisanship, it has bipartisan sponsorship. Now, not only will passing Glass-Steagall end the bailouts and initiate an FDR-style reorganization of the banks, which would put an end to the too-big-to-fail swindle, but it would likely lead to the ouster of President Barack Obama, who's been acting quite crazy lately. Obama will go berserk at the mere fact that Glass-Steagall has been being taken seriously, and if the popular support for this swells and he stands against it, it might embolden people in the administration and other senior figures in this country to walk him out of the White House, asserting Article 4 of the 25th Amendment. This will also clear the way for the U.S. government through the U.S. Treasury, at the direction of the Congress, to utter $1 trillion or more of credit to rebuild our collapsed industrial and agricultural sector, as well as our rapidly decaying infrastructure. And all that it's going to take to get it passed is your active, passionate mobilization. As Lyndon LaRouche said in comments to his organization during the course of this week, we have to end the denial of the American people about the crisis. We have to get them to realize that if they think they're being lied to, they are. There is no recovery. In fact, we're heading deeper and deeper and deeper into the greatest financial collapse and economic collapse in world history. And once people overcome that denial, and it's especially thick with baby boomers, then we have to inspire a dedicated minority to act. You don't need a majority. The majority will come, probably. But if we get people who understand the importance in its broadest context, including through looking at the galactic crisis that we face otherwise unprepared without Glass-Steagall, then perhaps we can get enough people motivated to move so that we can get it through as law and then deal with these other crises. To discuss this with me today, I have Hector Rivas, who's probably known to you from his role with LaRouche Pack Television, especially the While You Were Sleeping program he does many mornings, and Diane Sayre, who's one of the six LaRouche candidates running for Congress. So Hector and Diane, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks.
Hector, let me begin with you. House Resolution 1489 has been introduced. It's got three initiating sponsors. And LaRouche PAC has been advocating passage of a Glass-Steagall bill pretty much since Glass-Steagall was eliminated by Graham Leach Bliley in 1999. And certainly since the time of the crash, which Lyndon LaRouche identified in his July 25, 2007 webcast. So what are we doing at LPAC TV to mobilize the population for its passage?
Well, what I can tell you is that we want to make it very clear what the terms are, because what's obvious is that the nation itself, the United States, is very unique, and I think that's the first thing to consider on top of everything you just brought up, in which that the purpose of the United States, as it's demonstrated or as it reads in the preamble of the U.S. Federal Constitution, is to actually protect, nurture, and to have a nation based on developing itself on utilizing the powers of the human creative mind. And so that preamble very beautifully represents the principle by which this nation is to act in accordance to that measure. There's many challenges that civilization will come across, both natural and those unnatural by evil forces. In this case, to not be ambiguous, I'm talking about the British imperial financial factor that's still dominating the planet through the Inner Alpha Group. But regardless of that, it's the powers of the human imagination and creativity which gives us the power to defeat this, overcome this, and create a much greater circumstance for posterity in which the questions that we have now might be answered, but then there will be more advanced questions to resolve. And I think this is really heavily tied to this Kennedy space program and what we're trying to do on this galactic question. So what we're doing is we're getting the discussion on getting people to understand that, look, if this planet is under the thumb of an imperial monetarist policy, our nation does not have the power to act. And as you just mentioned, Harley, that part of that parasite is this Wall Street faction. So it's very simple. Glass-Steagall is very simple. All we're saying is to go back to what Franklin Roosevelt did with it, implement this policy to basically isolate the worthless, toxic debts that Barack Obama said in his 2010 State of the Union address, and in which the Congress, as we saw in that in his presentation, as recorded, cheered for, to isolate those things which Obama says are necessary for the American taxpayer to bail out. Absolutely nothing. Investments to gambling debts, investments towards nothing that's actually worth, that has nothing to do with actually preserving the welfare of future generations. So we're getting out that discussion, propagandizing on that topic on our website, and we're making a very clear point that, look, the way that what we're going to do with Glass-Steagall, once we get Glass-Steagall through, we want to be very clear about how we're actually going to utilize this power that we have chosen to give back to ourselves, in which we control our own credit, we control our own issues of finances, and that we don't feel obligated to bail out worthless assets that are generated from Wall Street and the British imperial faction.
Nominally. Hector, let me come back to that with you on this question, because I think this is very important, because a lot of our listeners are saying, well, yes, it would be good if we could get it, but how can you move the Congress? And one of the points that Lyndon LaRouche has been making is that we've got to cut out the politeness with the Congress. You know, there was a famous statement by Will Rogers, the comedian, that we only have one native criminal class in this country, and that's the U.S. Congress. Perhaps you should say criminally corrupt, because or just plain cowardly. So one of the things that some of our organizers are doing is now saying to Democrats and Republicans that this is not a partisan issue. It is an issue of saving the nation. But if you don't support Glass-Steagall, you're supporting the British Empire. You're supporting the mortal enemy of this nation. And I know that's been on your program on the While You Were Sleeping, but I think that's something we have to keep emphasizing, don't you?
Exactly. I don't think we can emphasize it enough, because at this point, look, we people do have to consider the history of this, and this is something that, you know, we draw back to in a lot of our video reports, more so in the past, but we're going to keeps digging in right now, and I think it was very well featured in a documentary we did that was released in, I think, September of last year under the title of The Takedown of Glass-Steagall, which is, look, do not forget that the germ of this, in a sense, was presented by Lyndon LaRouche under his Homeowners and Bank Protection Act of 2007. And that policy put forth 3 days after he accurately forecasted during his July 25, 2007 webcast that this system was about to go. We saw that about 3 days later. We saw Hank Paulson and a lot of these other, I don't have a polite word to use for them, but others of his type trying to turn this into a subprime crisis. Fine. But we knew what the matter was. Lynn called the shots on this and presented this thing in the next month, in the beginning of August. We could have actually resolved this problem back then. What happened? Well, aside from real rot like Barney Frank and Nancy Pelosi, you had a lot of members in Congress, Democrats and some Republicans, who you could say are good people or decent people, but they would not fight. They capitulated to the bullying of Barney Frank, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and so forth, and they said no, no Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, despite the fact that these nuts and their so-called experts were saying prior to the so-called collapse that there was no economic crisis, that Lyndon LaRouche is just being too extraordinary, he doesn't know what he's talking about, we got everything under control. Here this man's been saying this thing for, you know, decades. It happens. He introduces what the nation should have done, which is basically the equivalent of Glass-Steagall, and not only did this rot in the Congress stop it, but the majority of the Democratic Party capitulated and compromised. They squirmed in fear. They allowed fear to be the master of their decisions, and they didn't act. And we know what the consequences of this was, as Diane had pointed it out in a discussion earlier in the week, that, look, millions and millions of people are displaced, if not worse.
Hector, we could say on that you mentioned this 2007 turning point where LaRouche held his webcast on July 25th. You go a year later to 2008, before the September crash, where Lehman went under, Merrill Lynch and others, and the bailout started. Again, LaRouche was continuing to intervene, and what happened in that period was that after the bailout, and there was a tremendous reaction against the bailout, the Democratic Party, led by then-candidate Barack Obama, rallied behind Wall Street and the City of London and passed the bailouts, which initially were a $750 billion price tag, the official TARP bailout, but under the cover of TARP, it was trillions. And I think each step along the way there, LaRouche kept warning, kept talking about it. And we saw, even as late as the 2010 election period, there was a bill, the Dodd-Frank bill, which was a complete piece of crap. It was a worthless bill. It was the bill of the bankers. There was an effort by McCain and Cantwell to put through Glass-Steagall. And at that point, it was killed again. It was killed in the lame duck session. So we've seen what happens if you leave it to the Congress. And that's why we can't leave it to the Congress. Now, I want to bring in at this point Diane Sayre, who is a candidate for Congress, but is not running for, in a sense, 2012. She's trying to shape the policy today. Diane is one of the six LaRouche Democratic candidates for Congress. She's from New Jersey. Diane, what are you doing to mobilize right now constituents in the really the tri-state area that your district intersects?
Well, what all of us have done, the six of us and myself in particular, is we have been since January, when all of the state legislatures came back into session, going to the state houses and meeting with these people with the idea, look, you didn't run for election so that you could kill off your constituents. It's the law that state governments have to balance their budget. So unless you think outside of the box and you launch an offensive on the Congress to get Glass-Steagall through, you will have the blood on your hands of the people who are going to die directly as a result of these budget cuts. And I know what's occurred in some of these legislatures. Kentucky, I guess, Missouri, Alabama, is that there are resolutions for Glass-Steagall that have been introduced. We have some things working in other states where we may be able to address policy groups. But, you know, it is stunning the tendency of people to really want to stay within what they consider the boundary of acceptable, defined limits of what they're supposed to do. And it's a fight with each of these people when they say, well, isn't that federal legislation, to say, no, you have to make it personal to the congressman.
Well, Diane, I wrote an article, you may remember, just a few weeks ago on the situations in Texas and California on the road to hell, where I made precisely that point, that there has not been a single voice in any state legislature across the country that's pointed toward a national solution. Because these are not local economic crises. And of course, you're in the state of New Jersey where you have this fat blob, Christie, who looks like he's never met a Krispy Kreme donut shop he couldn't camp out in. But you got this guy who's essentially arguing that we've got to shut down education, shut down police and fire. I mean, he's not just talking about so-called wasteful spending. They're savaging police departments. And clearly, this is not a New Jersey problem because it's 46 or 47 states. So how do you communicate this when you talk to these local figures? Because I know you've also talked to city councilmen as well as state legislators.
Right. Well, we have one township, which means it represents about 12 little towns, which actually did pass the resolution, the Glass-Steagall resolution, to be forwarded to their congressman. Another one of the major cities of New Jersey, I think, is about to pass it this week. But it is, you know, to get this through to people, and they often don't think about it unless you talk to them and get them to draw out the consequences, like both, well, the three cities, Patterson, Camden, and Newark, have all been forced to lay off between 30 and 50% of their police forces, and something similar with the fire department. And I know
that's
in Newark,
had some consequences immediately, hasn't it?
Yes. Newark, we were able to actually get the statistics comparing January of this year after the layoffs to January of last year. The number of people shot in that month had doubled. The number of carjackings increased by 400%. Other theft increased by 38%. Now, I met with some representatives of the police force in Patterson who told me that in one respect, the mayor, who had claimed that laying off a third of the police force would not increase the crime, they said, well, there is a way that that might appear to be the case because we will not be able to respond to anything lower level than homicide.
So it won't be reported.
So, exactly. So there will be less crime reported.
Well, isn't that actually is their policy on unemployment. You don't count the unemployed, so it looks like the unemployment rate is dropping.
Right.
Aha. Uh-huh. So, Hector, is this why LaRouche is so unhappy with statistics?
I think it has a lot to do with it.
So, Diane, just to get back to the point then, what reaction do you get when you tell these people this is not a local problem, you have to move nationally?
Well, they're slow to move, but some of them are moving. You know, some of them are better. It's funny. The people that we've met with who have been open are a bit feistier in their local fights. Like they stood up, Christie tried to really blackmail the Patterson City Council by offering them a $6 million grant if they would decide on their budget within 5 hours from when he sent them the letter, which is pretty unbelievable. And the people who've been in touch with us on Glass-Steagall were the ones who stood up at the council meeting, which extended past the midnight deadline to vote on this stupid thing, and said, look, we're not going to be bullied by this guy. We're not going to vote. We're not happy with it. The people can't afford a 29% property tax increase. And they refused to behave or conform to the guidelines that Christie had given them. nonetheless, the city did just fire 125 police of a force that's just somewhat under 500.
Well, you're listening to the LaRouche Show. I have an announcement to make, which is that we will not be taking emails today. We're having a problem with the server and the computer or something. I don't know the exact technical side of it, but if you do have questions, you can send them in to radio@larouchepub.com, and we'll get them to Hector or Diane, and they can respond to you. Now, Hector, one of the things that comes up that Diane was just addressing is a certain amount of denial, that people just don't want to see how clear the crisis is. And this comes up in particular. I know there's been some discussion in Purcellville recently about the problem of the galactic crisis, earthquakes, where some people kind of say, well, you know, I really don't want to see an earthquake wipe out San Francisco, but that's way out there, so why does that matter to me? So we are dealing with denial. And I understand today Mr. LaRouche talked a little bit about some ideas about how to get beyond denial, which exists, whether it's economic policy or galactic policy. So can you give us a little insight into what the discussion was today on that?
Yeah, that's actually heavily related with what Diane just pointed out about illustrating the blood concreteness of sticking with the current policy. I mean, on the level that you see it with the budget cut, I mean, people can immediately have a central relation to an understanding that, one, there's an immediate cut to the fire department, and it's clear what that means. Response is very low. I mean, I've understood that even in California, we are just destroying our ability to deal with wildfires there, which is extremely prevalent, not necessarily anything new to people. Same thing goes with the teachers. Same thing goes with public services. I mean, God, I can just go down the list of this. But when you're looking at the same policy, you see how it affects the scientific frontier. I mean, the point is that from work that came out, namely towards the end of the summer of last year, simply by looking at the FAFSA record, which was a study conducted by the University of Berkeley in California, that there we find that there is some rhythm that's located in the FAFSA record. That's how we really do know this. A rhythm in which there seems to be an extinction and rise of different and new forms of species. And just to, you know, make a slight point that it's not a linear projection, but that this 62-million-year cycle seems to be there. Now, the one thing that you want to keep in mind is, okay, well, that's obviously in the fossil record. About 65 million years ago, we had the wipeout of the dinosaurs. I think it was the Triassic period is the official term of it. So technically, we're in the 3-million-year range of that exact cycle. And as Lynn pointed out, look, it's just a simple question. There's nothing out there that competently states that we can definitively determine that we're going to make it through this, that human civilization itself, amongst the other species now living, are completely safe from this. We don't know that. So just because that question is unanswered, we have to think about it. The only given that circumstance is like, look, it makes it very clear that why it was such a criminal action by Obama himself in taking down NASA, because that represents the core of how we would actually be able to investigate this.
Well, let's break this down into two components, because I want to continue with you on this, but I also know Diane did a trip to West Point, the U.S. Military Academy, this week. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, there are two areas that we can look at where Obama fails the test on both of them. One is the so-called first responder. You know, what kind of aid will be provided? This is what you both mentioned in terms of police and fire. And then the second one is the broader scientific question of looking for precursors and being able to forecast. So let me just start on the question of the in-depth capability. And some of that has to do with the Army Corps of Engineers. Diane, just give a little report on what you saw when you went to West Point.
Well, you know, it's a very striking thing. And first of all, it's huge. They have a vast area of very, very difficult terrain of mountainous areas and ravines, and you can see why it would be an excellent training ground for engineers, for people who are going to be skilled at building canals and railroads and that sort of thing. What I have been looking into, or what the Slate had been looking into, is the whole question of the chain of command in the case of a catastrophe, a natural disaster or otherwise. And this is somewhat alarming. First of all, the Army Corps has now been quite gutted, so that apparently it's the case that if you had to do a major evacuation or have a major emergency response, it would actually be the Army proper that would handle it. And the Army Corps would be called in to do things like power generation, maybe road clearing, things like that after the fact. But this also really, really underscores why Obama has to be ousted. I was reading some of our own literature, some of the EIR interviews and articles that came out around the time of Katrina, and I think FEMA, the Department of Homeland Security, and I believe even the NORTHCOM of the Army were moved into the region of where Katrina hit about 9 days before it hit New Orleans. But Bush was on vacation. So even though you had all of this manpower, which could have acted competently, maybe done an evacuation and who knows what, it was not mobilized under one command because the president, in effect, was missing in action. So you think about Obama, where if there's a disaster that exceeds the scope of a state to handle it, this is according to something called the National Response Framework, then the president is at the top of the chain of command. And if you don't have a president, you're really out of luck, because there has to be a point of coordination for NASA, which obviously should play a leading role in such a thing, the Army Corps, the Army proper, FEMA, which is the coordination between the federal agencies and the local first responders. You can imagine what a mess this would be if you had no central command.
And Diane, you mentioned the case of Katrina. Hector, I believe we just posted something today on the comparison with the Obama response for Haiti.
Yes, actually, it's the title says it all. And it's that, is Obama giving the Bay Area of California the Haiti treatment? Because it's exactly the case. Now, there hasn't been a major earthquake in the last day or in the last hour, as far as I know, in the Bay Area. But we know from the example of 1906, we know from what happened in 1989, that we shouldn't overlook the fact that that area is a very dangerous place, and it's a very heavily populated area. So if there were to be a 7.0 or higher earthquake in the Bay Area, which is, would result probably mainly from the San Andreas Fault, which extends, I forget exactly, a few hundred miles across the West Coast, you're talking about a lot of deaths here. You're talking about the possibility of many people dying. And if you look at what Obama's behavior towards Haiti, which is not different at all from George Bush's behavior towards what happened in Katrina, you really have to ask, is this president knowingly going to allow the Bay Area to be subsumed and consumed and destroyed by this disaster? Because what we do know is that there's not much in any effort to actually prepare for this. The simple case is the administration's takedown of these essential satellites that could help in earthquake forecasting. One of them was GOES. And in that case, specifically, the people who would receive the data that could at least detect some warning that there's about to be a major earthquake, those people were scrapped, and that's under the Obama administration. But it's just really that simple. Is if you are the president of the United States, you don't just look at a disaster like this and something like that could potentially happen in the Bay Area and turn a blind eye, unless you're a proud spokesman of genocide.
And that's been the obvious point. If you look at Obama's health care policy, if you look at the policy overall toward Haiti, you look at the policy with the NASA, with satellites, that's been the charge that's been made. And Diane, I know we just put out a statement, I think, written by your colleague Dave Christie that gets at the differences between what some other countries are doing compared to the United States. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I think this may shock some Americans because even Mexico, which has considerably fewer resources than the United States, but they did have a major quake in Mexico City, I think, in 85. So the president got together with the officials of Mexico City, and they're doing a series of earthquake drills and setting up alarm systems and all kinds of things in preparation and anticipation that a quake will hit Mexico City. Also, Japan, as people know, is probably the best prepared place on the planet. They built, you know, heavily, you can't say, it's not exactly fortified, but infrastructure that's designed to withstand major seismic shifts. And they also have a very, very elaborate warning system. And it begins with young school children actually knowing the difference between the four shocks of an earthquake where they might hide under the desk briefly while things are falling off the wall, and then there's apparently a break of maybe 30 seconds to 2 minutes before the real thing hits, where you run out of the building and get somewhere, you know, safe. This is completely part of the whole educational system that people are prepared for this. And then I think perhaps the most outrageous thing we heard, which anyone who heard the April 19th webcast in the questions, was that a Russian scientist was on who said, we were thrilled to hear that the head of NASA was coming to visit Russia. As you know, under Putin, we've increased our budget by 50%. We want to look at these precursors, and we know we need international collaboration and an international network. And he asked the head of NASA, will you collaborate with us? And the head of NASA said, well, of course, we agree that it's very important, but I regret to tell you that all of this has been cut out of the budget.
Yeah.
So I can make no commitment whatsoever for the United States to be a participant in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really is the most resounding indictment of the Obama administration, that we would come to the point where the head of NASA would have to tell the Russians, sorry, you go ahead without us. We have no budget for scientific research.
Well, this is exactly the point that Mr. LaRouche was making on Tuesday in the webcast. And I would encourage people to go to the LaRouchePact.com website. If you haven't seen it yet, you can watch Mr. LaRouche's webcast, which is an extensive discussion of the interrelated nature of three issues. One is the Obama presidency and why he must go. Secondly, why Glass-Steagall is essential to deal with the ongoing and accelerating disintegration of the financial system. And then third, the quality that's required to deal with this other question, the question of the solar systems traversing into a very dangerous neighborhood in the galaxy. Now, Hector, you said something earlier. You were talking about the unique nature of the United States with creativity as a principle. And one of the obvious points is that Mr. LaRouche talks about the U.S. as a credit system rather than a monetary system. And credit in itself is future-oriented. So I wonder if you want to just talk about that a little bit.
Well, for one thing is people, I've seen a lot of interesting biographies on the subject of Alexander Hamilton and his three famous reports on manufacturing, especially manufacturing, the National Bank, and on public credit. And what you're used to is a discussion of Hamilton's so-called banking aspect of his policy as a simply financial policy. And what they try to do is to get you to adopt the perception that it's a separate thought from what he was doing with his manufacturer's report. But even outside of that, why Hamilton was trying to organize an actual city based on industrial development, which I think eventually became Patterson. It didn't succeed, I think, initially on his part, but it actually came back. So you think about this thing, you have to think from the standpoint of, you know, the totality of this man's mind. you see the similar aspect of John Quincy Adams attempting to use, or actually trying using the powers given to him through, under the National Bank to actually do what? Use credit under the power of Congress, as it states in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, to develop the nation with the most advanced forms of technology to improve the power of productivity. In his case, it was the canals, and, you know, railroads were coming in at that time, and I think there was something called the General Survey Act, which gave the United States a certain capability to geographically map out how they would build some of these railroads that were just, you know, coming in. You see the same thing with Lincoln. So when you take into account the totality of these men's mind, and other minds too, but specifically these, which are very clear, very transparent, and their writing says it all, you get an idea that credit is inseparable from the idea of the future, as you just said, Harley. It's very clear from their design of how they view that the development of the territory of the nation is to take place. Now, you just take that as a principle. Look, they were using the most advanced forms of technology that they had available to their time, right?
Yeah.
We have to look at our case today and say, okay, well, how do we do that? Obviously, we're not just going to build a 19th-century steam engine. We have a lot more.
Some of our rail problems, that would be an improvement right now.
Exactly. But actually, as sad as it sounds, it would be.
Yeah.
But indeed, we have nuclear power, we have fusion, and we have a lot of other things that are just not discussed because we have no real leadership in the presidency. So this is the idea of credit, is that it gives the nation the power to act. When we say that we have to actually use the powers of the U.S. Constitution to act in the benefit of the future, don't be general about it. This is what it means. It means science. And today, we can't block, as they did with the railroads back then, canals, iron, steel, and things of that form. We must now do it in our way with nuclear power, fission, fusion, and everything that will come out of the NASA program, and everything that will come out as a consequence of understanding how to forecast earthquake precursors.
And this is what Mr. LaRouche means these days when he's talking about platforms rather than infrastructure, rather than what we ordinarily assume as the nuts and bolts projects. He's actually talking about science and the advance of ideas overall.
Yeah, that's why he initiated the Science of Glass-Steagall video, where you take into account, okay, let's not even look at the noetic sphere, that is, you know, cognition, human beings. Let's just look at life itself operating under the guidance of the intention of the universe. And what do you see? You see these single-celled organisms, right, gathering iron that I guess was an iron, not oxide. It wasn't iron oxide, but just all iron that actually was not insoluble with water. They take it in. Consequence of it is they produce oxygen. These things would die. And, you know, especially when the iron would oxidize and it would come down and it would, we understand that it had the effect of actually killing some of these organisms themselves. And so you have these iron deposits, while at the same time, these microorganisms are utilizing iron as a function for themselves to be alive, to create what? The beginnings of the Earth's atmosphere.
There's a beautiful video on this with Michelle Fuchs and Cody Jones up on the website, I think. Can't remember the title of it, Hector. What was the title?
Oh, is this The Science of Glass-Steagall?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right.
Well, which people could just, yeah, I mean, it's good you pointed out. People should just watch it because the presentation is good, and I think it definitely speaks for itself. But you're forced to acknowledge one thing, that this is what creativity is, and this is what the platform's idea is. It's not like a thing kinetically causing another thing to happen. It's you're watching a process creating an environment, in a sense you can say a field for higher states of organizations to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because without the process of these things, yes, there are more complex, so-called more advanced organisms out there, mammals, reptiles, us, of course, obviously, that came into through being. But look at the effect of a what you can call a less advanced state of organism creating the platform for everything else to come into existence on the face of this Earth. An atmosphere, the magnetosphere, right? The ionosphere, actually, as a matter of fact. The ionosphere is a result of the biosphere interacting with solar plasma and solar activity.
Well, and this is, Diane, let me bring you back in, because this is, I think, what Hector just went through is what Lyndon LaRouche has argued should be the basis of discussion in any political campaign right now, that politics has changed so that politics now requires science as statecraft. Now, the problem we have is that we live in a society where people are practical, where people have been brainwashed into thinking that ideas don't matter. So in your campaigning, how do you bring in these ideas, and what's the challenge? How do you deal with the challenge to move people around these higher concepts?
Well, I have to say it's interesting, because actually people are so surprised when you bring up something scientific, because they don't think it's part of politics, quote unquote. They have no defenses for it, and we often get a much, much more engaged response.
Yeah, political science.
On our last
visit
to Harrisburg, we were fortunate that Cody Jones from the basement could join us. And first of all, people are very nervous about the probability and likelihood of major quakes hitting the United States. I think most people actually think that this is a very real possibility. And I noticed it also yesterday when I was at West Point, and I went to the visitor's desk to ask them about filming a statement there. And as soon as I said the word earthquakes, the silence was tangible. Everybody was listening to what I was saying about it. And what happened in Harrisburg was these legislators, I thought when you started talking about 62-million-year cycles and extinction crises that their eyes would glaze over, but instead they would lean forward and pay rapt attention to every single detail. So it's actually, I think, quite exciting, and there's an openness there on the science question, which may allow us to flank them on the things that they're blocked on, or what they typically consider politics as usual.
I was going to say, political science is one of those oxymorons. As someone with a degree in political science, there's nothing scientific about it. But also, Diane, besides the institutional networks, and there's a problem with these institutions because they still play politics, which is, in other words, gutless belly rubbing, which goes on in every single state legislature and city council. We've got to bring in the population. So what is the response that you, I know you and I talked about this during the week, you began to get a significant shift in the day-to-day organizing by bringing in these galactic questions and the necessity for Glass-Steagall. Why don't you give us a little sense of that?
Well, it's fascinating because we have signs up on Is California Next on the Earthquake? We have signs up on Obama's shutdown of NASA. And we have signs on Glass-Steagall. And, of course, we have the Obama stash, the famous Obama with the little mustache sign. And people march up on removing Obama, and we're also getting a pattern of marchers on Glass-Steagall. Well, people, we had a guy, we were set up on a university campus, which is in the middle of a downtown area, and a sort of baby boomer aged guy who was in the middle of jogging with his wife. She crossed the street. He saw Glass-Steagall and came jogging over to our table, completely disrupting whatever his routine was, to find out what we were saying about Glass-Steagall. It turned out he was in banking, and he said, this is absolutely right. We have to do this. What's happening? Became a contact. We're finding it cuts across all party lines. We signed up a LaRouche PAC membership from a Republican Party elected official in a small town who said, you know, I was really angry when Bush started the bailout. I think Bush destroyed the Republican Party. And he was foolish enough to have been hopeful about Obama. And then he said, it turns out Obama was even worse. And when he saw the sign where we have the list of the InterAlpha Group banks, he said, these are the scoundrels that got all that money. So there's a sharp response on Glass-Steagall. And then the other thing that Americans take very personally is the shutdown of NASA. People consider this part of the great mission of the United States, is science, space exploration, discovering the planet, discovering what's here. People will come over and say, no, when they cut NASA, that was personal.
Do you get that from young people also, Diane?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, we've had a number of young people. They don't tend to know as much, but there seem to be more rocket clubs than I realized existed that people are involved in.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hector, let me come back to you because we talked about this a little bit. We touched on it before, but I think this is one of the important things that came out of the discussion with Mr. LaRouche today and also yesterday, this question of drama. How do you bring people into this so you capture their full attention? I know we had the first foray into that with the little documentary done this morning by posted by Chance McGee, but how do you see this? How do we get people, say, in East Oshkosh or Allentown, Pennsylvania, to recognize their stake in this galactic question?
Yeah, actually, that's the challenge, and I'll just point that I am no expert in Shakespeare. but look, I mean, the one thing is right, that does come up. How easy it is for somebody in the East Coast or in the South to say, well, this 62-million-year cycle thing, yeah, I can see how that's the case, but those earthquakes are on the West Coast. So I don't see why we need to worry about it. Well, here's the thing. The planet is a lot more complex because we're not just talking about earthquakes. There's many eruptions that planet Earth takes.
I can mention one really quickly. Just last week, I drove through that string of tornadoes that ripped through Oklahoma, Arkansas, Mississippi, and North Carolina. And there was a tornado today that tore apart the St. Louis, Missouri airport. So the early appearance of these kinds of tornadic activity is also related to the same question, I presume.
Sure. Well, that's the question, right? I mean, and I was going to mention that and a couple of other things, because keep in mind the 62-million-year fossil record, what it tells us as a fact in terms of cycles that happen and how it affects the consequences of certain species to exist or not. You look at the earthquakes in relation to this as a question, and it's a totally valid question. We know already the effects are. We know what it did to Sumatra. Obviously, Haiti is very real to anybody and so forth. Immediately, yes, because of the major faults in the West Coast, you see immediately how the Bay Area is in danger. I mean, it's on a peninsula. Very unsafe if we don't take actions on it. You have Washington State, and you have Los Angeles, obviously. But now think about all the things that could actually be involved in shaking up planet Earth as a consequence of where we are in the galaxy. But one thing, volcanic activity is not necessarily too inseparable from this process. And you have to consider in that level, one, that there has been a correlation of increased volcanic as well as major earthquake activity on planet Earth. So you think about one thing. You think about people in Wyoming who think they're safe. Well, I have news for you. Even the magma, the hot lava that we knew to exist beneath Yellowstone Park, the magnitude of that we've totally underestimated. From studies that I think that were that resulted of last week, using some form of electrical imaging technique, I forget the exact term of it, but we're able to determine that we greatly underestimated the level of magma under the Yellowstone. What we're talking about here is not just some normal volcano. We're talking about a cauldron, which from studies that I think have suggested from scientists is that there seems to be some form of 600,000-year cycle in which this volcano, this super volcano, erupts. The effect of it goes way beyond the state of Wyoming. We've known that there are crater and markings that show that this thing goes, the explosions of its effect as far as Utah. So this is a major situation. Now, the last time that we recorded, as far as we understand now, that this 600,000-year cycle occurred with this super volcano in the state of Wyoming was about 660-something years ago, which indicating that we're probably overdue for some type of eruption of this type. And then you look at the tornadoes that you just described, Harley.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from what we know it's done, it's obviously the recent reports of how it greatly damaged the airport in St. Louis. But here's one thing to keep in mind. The levels of tornadoes that have hit that area have not been as great of this, have not been of this magnitude since, I believe it was said 1984, 1989. I forget exactly which year it was. So we haven't had this level of touchdowns of these types of tornadoes, of this level of tornadoes since that period, 1984. And in addition, so far, we've actually already beat the record of the level of heightened tornado activity that had occurred in that part of the United States since 1984. Are these things related? We don't know. But there is a very interesting correlation that we cannot overlook or ignore.
What? And I think that we're talking with Hector Rivas and Diane Serre. Hector is with LPAC TV. Diane, she's a candidate for Congress in New Jersey as a LaRouche Democrat, part of the slate of six. And what we're discussing is essentially two things, the interrelationship between the galactic crisis and all its implications, from earthquakes to tornadoes. I mean, Hector, I'm not going to ask you to discuss the changing of the poles and what that means in terms of the losing of the electromagnetic field of the planet and what that might mean in terms of being bombarded with cosmic radiation. But these are some of the kinds of questions that we have to answer as we enter into what LaRouche has called a pretty bad neighborhood in our galaxy. But at the same point, we do have to come back to realizing that man as a creative being can address these kinds of questions, provided we use the instruments of government to give us the capacity to do that. And that's why we're talking about the need to get rid of President Obama, and also the importance of Glass-Steagall as an absolutely essential defense of our nation. Now, Diane, what's planned in the immediate period ahead to move the population on the Glass-Steagall fight with you and the other candidates?
Well, what we're doing here, for example, is we have emailed out to our networks the central emails for all of the state legislators, obviously the phone numbers for their congressmen and their city councils, because what the average citizens can do is to, I have sort of an image, is we can pop these local elected officials out of thinking within the box, get them on fire that they really shouldn't be killing off their constituents, and they really should go to the Congress to get as many co-sponsors as we possibly can now that we do have an actual bill in the Congress. But we definitely should not have the illusion that we're going to sit on our hands and wait for Congress to organize it. I think Bernanke and Geithner apparently are in like some full court press mobilization to even contact congressmen that they think might be considering co-sponsoring Glass-Steagall. And we know from last year that the British consider implementation of Glass-Steagall an act of hostility against the empire. So, this is a real war, and it is life and death. And I think people really have to get that in their gut and then act accordingly. It's not the case that the average person can't do anything. The average person can do an enormous amount by using the powers embedded in our Constitution to force this issue and to force this thing through and to hold everyone who's been elected to represent us accountable.
And what will I assume we'll be putting up, I think you did, didn't you do a statement at West Point that should be up?
Yeah, I did one yesterday, which hopefully will be up soon, which took up a little bit about the question of, because I do think there's an enormous amount of denial about earthquakes hitting the West Coast or somewhere else, or a tornado, you know, a tornado strikes down in one area and it seems like it's a limited area. It's people would prefer to block it out. When you look at this New Madrid zone, the Tennessee Valley that LaRouche was talking about, California, I looked at that as a cross grid with maps of winter wheat crops and beef production. And what you can, I mean, California, I think, is the eighth largest economy in the world as countries. So the type of devastation that would occur, I think, is beyond anything that anyone is thinking of. And if you start to think it through, you begin to see the real urgency of Glass-Steagall. You know, last week, a month ago, it should have been done. We need it right this minute. And the necessity of removing Obama because of the question of the chain of command and where is the center of that going to be if some major crisis occurs.
Well, and Hector, let me just come back to you because you've been covering a lot more recently the situation in Europe with your morning program while you were sleeping. I assume you're going to continue to highlight this. There was a very fascinating story that came out of Italy this week. That is, there was an attempt to attack the economy minister of Italy, Tremonti, for his association with LaRouche. So I assume you're finding quite a bit of interesting material coming out of this breakdown in Europe.
I mean, it just comes very interesting in the light that the main thing that I usually have to say whenever I look at what's going on in Europe, and by I mean what's going on in Europe, I'm talking about the dead side of it. It's precisely that. It's this place, I don't know why they're alive, but they clearly just want to, they love the idea of living in failure. They love the idea of Europe living under the legacy of being a whore for imperial interests. So you see something like Tremonti as indicative of that. But I have a lot of hopes, mainly because, you know, you have the very powerful role of Helga and the Buzo party out there, also of Jacques Chaminade. And it just shows you that, look, society does not have to go over the way old Europe. All they have to do is listen to Lynn LaRouche, and you have very few individuals in Europe who already are taking up that charge. And if Europe, and mainly to European people, not to the institutions there, because they already are dedicated to being failures and wishing to see the destruction of their nation, but to the people of Europe, we just simply say, as well as to the United States, that all you have to do is go with LaRouche. We get Obama out, we reenact Glass-Steagall, and we can take the nation back.
And Diane, we have a couple of minutes left. Any last words from you for today?
Well, just on Europe, that I loved that interview from the parliamentarian Iceland, because it is indicative how when we should keep in mind our enemies are totally bankrupt, and we don't know how little or how much it will take to finish them off, but I suspect it's much less than they're letting on to, which is another reason to go for the jugular for this Glass-Steagall, because that will be the end of the British Empire.
Yeah, Glass-Steagall will hit the Inter-Alpha group of Lord Jacob Rothschild, which is at the center of the shift after 1971 to an imperial monetarist system, which included the closing down of our industry in the United States. And Hector, that's what we've got to do. We've got to revitalize American industry. I assume as a young man, you're confident that's going to occur, and you're going to play a role in that.
Well, that's the way it's going to occur, is that we all have to play a role in that, and I'm definitely in there, as well as obviously Diane and the six candidates.
And people should stay in touch with the website. There will be more coming from the candidates, as well as Hector, I guess we have another minute here. What are you guys going to be putting up in the next couple of days? What's in the works for the website?
Keep on good watch on how we're going to develop this picture of the criminal negligence that Obama is portraying on dealing with these disasters. We're going to re-hit the Bay Area question. And for those who want to live in denial, we got a little surprise for what's come in store in your area, as I very briefly indicated earlier, with these tornadoes, the New Madrid line, the super volcanoes, which stretch far across the United States, far across from the West Coast, very close to the East Coast. So there's going to be a series of things of that sort that we are going to be preparing.
And I understand from just a little bit of a report I got that Mr. LaRouche has encouraged you to use the principle of Hamlet's ghost, the ghost in Hamlet, to cause the goosebumps on people's backs to actually see that this is something that affects them. It's not just something out in the ether somewhere.
Right, exactly.
So you will be a Shakespeare scholar next time I have you on the program then.
I'll do my best.
All right, well, Hector, thank you very much. It's Hector Rivas Jr. from LaRouche Pack TV, who does the While You Were Sleeping, as well as periodic other programs, and Diane Sayre, Democratic candidate for Congress in New Jersey. And keep your eye on LaRouchePack.com for upcoming stories on this. And go back and look at the webcast. And if you haven't seen it yet, look at it now, from Lyndon LaRouche from Tuesday, April 19th. So this has been the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 23rd, 2011. Join us again next week for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.